staying strong in Burundi today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Repression and violence are on the rise again in Burundi. This activist tells her kids,
your country and your values, your principles, your beliefs are stronger than the fear that you feel.
The region's seen trouble like this before, and the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. wants to make sure it doesn't happen again.
We can't say it is a genocide, but I don't think that one would be exaggerating the crisis on the ground by saying that we worry that history could repeat itself in Burundi.
Plus, why Europe has only itself to blame for letting the U.S. dictate policy on Syria.
They themselves have laid down willingly under the bus and allowed the Americans to drive the bus over them quite a few number of times.
Those stories and more today on The World. We're going to kick things off today in a country we don't often go to on a map of Africa. Burundi is a little hard to find if you don't know where it is. But our first two guests know the Central African country very well and are seriously worried about what's going on there.
You almost want to hold the globe and shake it and say, look at what's happening.
That's Burundian poet Keti Nivyabandi. She led all women protests through the streets of the capital, Bujumbura, last spring. We'll hear more from her and why she's so angry in a few minutes. One of the reasons has to do with something Amnesty International revealed today. Satellite images that seem to show five new mass graves near the capital. If confirmed, they're likely the result of fighting there since April. That's when Burundi's president announced he would run for a third term, ignoring a constitution that barred him from doing so. Our first guest is the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power. She was in Burundi last week and had her own brush with government officials. When she tried to talk with reporters at Bujumbura's airport, officials tried to push them apart. You can see her on YouTube telling them, don't touch me, I'm talking to the press, I can do what I want. And she did.
Held a press conference, but I think we also got a window into some of the darker tendencies that exist in that country and with the government right now.
Those darker tendencies have created a climate of fear in Burundi that Ambassador Power describes as acute.
What you have so far are hundreds of people who have been killed, people in Bujumbura, the capital, waking up most mornings and seeing bodies in the streets, 240,000 refugees who have fled to neighboring countries, and a climate of widespread fear that the crisis could escalate and that a match could be laid down, lighting up whole communities that so far have stayed peaceful. One of the reasons that the international community and the African Union are so seized with the challenges in Burundi right now is because we know the history and we see things escalating and not de-escalating, and we see people becoming more fearful, and people in the part of government militias, but also in some in the opposition, becoming better armed, and that does not bode well. So we can't say it is a genocide, but I don't think that one would be exaggerating the crisis on the ground by saying that we worry that history could repeat itself in Burundi.
There have been lots of allegations that neighboring Rwanda is training and supporting opponents of Burundi's government. Did you see any evidence of that?
Well, our mobility was restricted so much by the government that I cannot say that we had the kind of exhaustive look at the situation on the ground. But we believe the reports of Rwandan involvement are credible, and we have exerted public and private pressure on Rwanda to do nothing to further destabilize a situation that really could get out of hand in a hurry.
Well, you tried to follow up, I gather, with activists and others you'd met on a previous trip to Burundi. What did you learn about these people?
Just looking at the list of journalists, human rights defenders, women's rights activists, lawyers, etc., that I had met with on my first trip in my current job in April of 2014 versus now, a year and a half later. And when I went down the list, basically next to each of the names of the individuals I'd met, it was a stark catalog of how much the situation had deteriorated. So next to one name, it would say fled, the next one fled, the third one in hiding, the fourth one in Burundi, but not at the meeting, too scared to come to the meeting, the fifth one shot, Pierre Clavier Mbomina, one of the great human rights defenders in Burundi, was shot in the throat and in the face and is recovering in Brussels. It is not just what civil society said or didn't say to the UN Security Council when we visited, but what is left of civil society, and did they even feel free to come forward and engage with the international community in order to share their concerns? And the answer is, by and large, not.
I mean, given the number of crises that the UN seems unable to deal with, refugees, Syria, ISIS, whatever, where the U.S. is hardly leading from the front or from behind, are the kinds of genocide prevention mechanisms you've long called for possible?
Well, I think that there are a range of things that the Obama administration has done, the U.N. have done, that actually increase our preparedness to respond to mass atrocities. It's now routine that we would set up a commission of inquiry and name names. It's routine that we would put in place arms embargoes in different crisis situations to try to stem the flow of arms, high-level engagement by the President of the United States or by the Secretary of State or myself preventively now happens as a matter of course, even in places that aren't right smack dab in the middle of what the American people are thinking about every day, you know, like some of these, the Central African Republic or Burundi, are not areas that citizens think about that often in this country. And yet we try to examine the tools in the toolbox, see what can be deployed, what might make a difference. The fact of the matter is the system is bursting at the seams with more than 60 million displaced persons. Conflicts are lasting much longer than they used to. The average refugee used to be displaced under 10 years, and now that's up near 20 and counting. So we've invested more humanitarian assistance in trying to help those who are fleeing conflict, who are living in conflict areas, but the demand is outpacing the supply of resources. And we deploy mediators, but just because you deploy a mediator and energetically work to get peacekeepers deployed doesn't mean that the president of a country is inclined to put his people first. And so fundamentally, the purpose of a lot of those atrocity prevention measures is to ensure that we never leave a tool in the toolbox that we might employ that might make a difference. But at the end of the day, we also need leaders in these countries to be responsible and to put the welfare of their people first.
The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Burundian Keti Nivyabandi never expected to become a political activist. She's a poet, an essayist, and a parent. But when Burundi's president dug in his heels last April and decided not to leave office, violence erupted. Keti and some of her friends decided to lead their own all-women's protest, a peaceful one. But the government did not see it that way.
We were tear gassed. They brought huge water cannons at us. At one point, actually knelt in front of a water cannon, and it was still, shooting straight at us. And the police was heavily armed. And, here we were, women singing our national anthem, having our white handkerchiefs and walking peacefully. We presented no threat to the police.
Yeah.
But the level of repression was absolutely unspeakable.
So you were resolute. Were you frightened? What were the other women feeling?
To tell you the truth, when I first saw all these policemen, fully armed and the water cannons and the tear gas, I was scared. I was terrified. But I also understood right there in that moment that this was a decisive time, that we could not keep running away. That if we run away today, we'll run away forever. At some point, you have to stand up and overcome the fear in order to defend what it is that you think is right. So despite the fear, despite the violence, we stayed together and we said to ourselves, at the end of the day, this is tear gas, these are water cannons. Even if they shoot us, we have to stand for the truth and we have to stand for the dignity and integrity of the country. So the fact that we were together and comforted each other gave us strength. And personally, having organized this, I couldn't go back. I looked at these women and said, we cannot go backwards. We have to go forth. We have to, finish what we started.
And you're a mother, too.
Yes, I am.
How did you explain what was happening to your children? What do you say to them to not scare them?
Right. And because they've been hearing this, they actually saw pictures. But what I tell them is that, your country and your values, your principles, your beliefs are stronger than the fear that you feel. And I tell them that, what I'm doing is for them, for them to be able to live in a Burundi where they're free, where they're able to, fully bloom and blossom. And that it will also be their responsibility when they are older to make sure that justice and freedom freedom are upheld. You know, you can't just sit by as a citizen and watch as, you know, as injustice is being done to other people. We are responsible for each other's peace and stability and a sense of justice. I think that's the lesson that I want to leave with them.
You said there was no going back with your activism, but you fled Burundi to Canada, which is where you are now. What happened? Mm-hmm.
So after our demonstration, what happened is that a coup was attempted in Burundi, and it actually happened while we were on the streets, which was quite something, and the coup failed. So immediately after that, a very severe repression started, and you know, we all knew that we were all in danger. The reason I fled was because I had children, quite honestly. Mm. My kids had left Bujumbura just a few days before the crisis started. They were in a neighboring Rwanda. And I knew that if I stayed longer, I risked my life. I also risked not being able to see them for a long time. But I think if I didn't have children, I certainly would not have left. But I would also, in most likelihood, be dead by now. But I'm not the only one. So many others have had to flee the country. You know, anyone really who has a strong opinion or who has who is either an intellectual, an artist, a human rights defender, a politician, you know, anyone who has a voice and raises it has had to leave the country.
You're living with this on a daily basis in Canada. How hard is it to be so entwined with what's happening back home, something so close to you, and not to be home?
It's a very, very difficult situation. I can't begin to explain it, because first you're dealing with the heartache and the hardship of exile, which in itself is traumatic. It's hugely traumatic, you know, becoming a refugee. And as you go through that, you're seeing on a daily basis what's happening, and you feel powerless. You want to do something, but you can't. You're confined in this exile and in this very limited space. As a writer, as a poet, I find it extremely hard to even write about it. So I find myself just keeping busy in the day-to-day activism, and it's a very hard situation to go through.
What is the role of a poet when so many lives are at stake?
I find myself asking the same question. You carry forward the cries, the anguish of the people. You become that voice, or one of the voices, for that hurt and that pain. That's one thing. But at the same time, looking at, again, at my countrymates, you do want to offer something for them to hang on to. So you are torn between becoming a sort of a wall of lamentations, between singing the pain and also singing the beauty of Burundi, to remind them of what we are and as a people, of what we can be and why we are fighting anyway. So it's a conflicting and blurry line. But ultimately, I think a poet's role is to be as true as possible to what one is experiencing and is feeling inside, and to express it to the best of our ability. That's the small contribution that you can give.
Burundian poet and activist Keti Nivyabandi led an all-female street movement in the capital, Bujumbura. She's been speaking with me from Calgary, her home in exile. Keti, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, too. Thank you very much.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Last night, immigration and refugee policies came to the forefront of the Republican presidential debate. Donald Trump was not around to suggest a ban on Muslim immigration, though Ben Carson seemed happy to take his place.
If you've got 10 people coming to your house and you know one of them is a terrorist, you're probably going to keep them all out. You know, we probably have to figure out a way to make sure that we keep America safe.
And that was how Carson answered a question about the economy from a Latina entrepreneur. Still, the rhetoric seemed less inflammatory than in some earlier debates, and some candidates made a point of avoiding blanket comments about Muslims and undocumented immigrants. Joe Enriquez Henry organizes Latino voters in Iowa, a state that's just days away from picking its favorite presidential candidates. Joe joins me from Des Moines. What did you hear in the rhetoric around immigration last night, Joe? Did anything change in your ears?
Well, it was an interesting discussion, especially between Bush and Rubio. Bush took on Rubio and said, listen, you worked to provide a pathway to citizenship. And he accused Rubio of changing his mind. Of course, Rubio acknowledged that. That was a significant discussion that happened right there. What I got out of that was Bush was stating that he was for legal status. But I did not hear that from Rubio or Cruz or any of the other candidates.
You're actually talking about issues that they spoke about. There was a dialogue, in a way, about immigration. Whereas before, it often seemed like a lot of responses to Donald Trump. He was the lightning rod. Do you think the shift in rhetoric is suggestive of, you know, the absence of Donald Trump? Or is it something else going on?
Well, I think that's part of it, because clearly when Trump has been there before, all he has talked about was building a wall, not letting anybody in. No other presidential candidate on that end wanted to talk about any type of pathway to citizenship. So without Trump in the room, that allowed for a more thorough discussion and analyzing the positions of each of those candidates.
Interestingly, the candidates lump together immigration. And in immigration, there are different types of migration.
Oh, exactly.
From Syrian refugees to undocumented immigrants. Why do you think they were just kind of talking about it in this very generic way?
Well, I think they were speaking to their majority constituency, who would rather view immigrants as those people coming from Mexico and Central America, without looking at the big picture. I mean, clearly there were intelligent candidates in that room last night who know better, and clearly Bush knows better since he's married to a Latina and his sons are very much Latino. So the knowledge is there. They were pandering. They have been pandering on that issue, but it was more enlightening last night without Trump being there to throw out his hate.
What do you think Latino voters came away with after hearing last night's debate?
I think it's more optimistic at this point, because clearly we do have a percentage of our community who've always looked at the conservative point of view. But it's been hard for them to determine whether or not they could go into a Republican caucus on Monday night and feel comfortable about it. They like what they're hearing now.
Joe Enriquez Henry, Vice President of the League of United Latin American Citizens, speaking with me from Des Moines. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Zika is the word in Brazil now. Brazil seems to be ground zero for the mosquito-borne virus that the World Health Organization says is spreading explosively through the Americas. It all sounds really alarming, but remember, the main concern is for pregnant women and a suspected link with a birth defect, microcephaly, babies born with small brains. And it's just suspected, not confirmed. Most cases of Zika involve mild symptoms, a rash, aches, and mild fever. We've been speaking this week with my colleague at Global Post, Will Carlos, in Rio. He's been writing about the Zika outbreak there. You've been digging in on the numbers, and you have some questions, I understand.
Yeah, that's right. I've been, you know, I'm kind of skeptical by nature, and I've been taking a very skeptical look at the numbers coming out from the Ministry of Health, and also the numbers that are being reported and kind of thrown around, and I think it's fair to say creating kind of worldwide panic about this at this point. And, you know, there's a few discrepancies, there's a few mistakes, and there's just a few things that I think kind of need to be cleared up.
Yeah, what pops out specifically?
Well, let's go back to what you said a minute ago about the WHO, you know, talking about Zika, you know, exploding across the world. I mean, the fact is, I called the Ministry of Health in Brazil 2 days ago and I said, hey guys, you know, what's the deal? How many cases of Zika are there? And the answer I got was, we have no idea. They have no idea how many cases there are. And I said, well, hold on a minute. I've seen reported in major newspapers between 500,000 and 1.5 million. And the guy sort of said, okay, give me a minute. And he went away and he came back and he said, yeah, that's kind of what we're telling people, but the bottom line is we have no idea. I mean, how on earth are they supposed to know how many people are sitting out there in towns and villages and, you know, in the middle of the Amazon jungle sitting there with the Zika virus? I mean, there's not really any way of telling.
So you believe that the reports are overblown?
I think the reports are inaccurate, basically. I think we need to be very careful about saying, look, the bottom line is we don't know how big this is. What we all need to bear in mind is that when you look at the numbers, I've heard on the radio, I've seen on TV, you know, thousands of children being born with misshapen heads with small heads. That's not true, okay? There have been thousands of reported possible cases of microcephaly across Brazil, a country in which, it should be said, 8,000 children are born every day, right? So there are thousands of cases out there. Of those cases, there have only been 270 actually confirmed cases of microcephaly. Now, the number of those that are actually linked to Zika virus, absolutely conclusively, is only 6. Mm. So we're in the single digits in terms of the kids that have been born with misshapen heads, and we know for sure that it was caused by the Zika virus.
For now, though, Zika is something that the International Olympic Committee has to deal with the Olympics coming to Rio next summer. What is the IOC doing?
So the IOC, you know, it's putting pressure on the Brazilian Ministry of Sports to go into the stadiums, to fumigate, to make sure that they're clean, to make sure that there aren't, you know, pools of water sitting around and mosquitoes around. They are saying, everybody is trying to sort of tamp it down and say, hey, look, the Olympic Games are going to go ahead and everything's going to be fine. And basically what they're doing is they're saying, we're going to keep you safe. If you're coming to the Olympics, either as an athlete or to watch the games, we're going to keep you safe and everything's going to be okay.
What other specific guidelines do you think they should be thinking about?
Well, as far as what they should be thinking about, I mean, look, if you're going to come to Rio, it should be pointed out this will be during the dry season, so there will be fewer mosquitoes around, hopefully. You've got to cover up. You've got to wear your mosquito repellent. You've got to try as hard as you can not to get bitten. Do all the practical things that you should always do when you visit a country where there are nasty diseases and nasty mosquitoes that will bite you and make you sick.
So what about Brazilians themselves? Are they confident that between their government and the IOC guidelines, they'll be protected?
You can't see my face, but I'm grinning at the idea that Brazilians might be confident in their government doing anything, because, you know, this is such a skeptical place. I mean, Brazilians hate their politicians. They're just kind of dealing with it. You know, I mean, they've got so many problems to deal with. The economy's in a mess. We've got Carnival coming up in a week. It's a cliche, but I mean, people are sort of hoping that they get a bit of a respite from bad news, I think. And they're going to do what they've always done, which is sort of take care of themselves. And, you know, if the government does something to help them, then great, but don't count on it.
Will Carlos reporting from Rio de Janeiro for our partners at Global Post. Thanks a lot, Will.
Thanks, Marco.
Later on the show, musicians in the Haitian diaspora return to the island to record songs with young Haitian artists back home. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A son fires a tough question at his bilingual father.
Why did you kill Spanish in our family?
His dad shoots back.
I don't know. A good question. I don't know. Get yourself an appointment, get a therapist, and work your way through it.
Father, son, and a struggle over a lost family language coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The debate over immigration in the presidential race has led to some hostile talk, and people are feeling that hostility. Just this week, I read about a Moroccan immigrant in Philadelphia who says he got beaten up because someone heard him speaking Arabic in the street. Language is about identity, and some immigrants hold fast to their languages, but sometimes a family's language disappears. You may know we produce a podcast about language here called The World in Words, and this week's edition has a wonderful personal story from one of our producers, Bradley Campbell. It's about the loss of Spanish in Bradley's family and the grudge he held onto for years. Here's Bradley.
My father killed Spanish years before I was born. Three, in fact. 1978. The year my sister came into the world. To the best of our knowledge, that's when Spanish in our family died. But my sister Kate and I, we never knew why.
I think I may have questioned him.
Like, what would you say? Like, you came home, you're like, Dad, why are you a bum?
No. I think I just asked him why he didn't teach it to us.
My father is from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. He's a native Spanish speaker, no accent. And it's his fluency that drives me crazy. He didn't pass it down to us. As children, he only spoke to us in English. The only fluent thing we can do, if you can even call it that, is this.
Good.
See, it's not. We have some amount of fluency.
We do, right? Right. Yeah. We can roll our R's.
We can roll our R's. Oh, high five.
High five. Nice.
But that's it. Everything else, it's filtered through a thick American accent. Today, our Spanish is pathetic.
Hola, ¿cómo estás? Por favor, introduce yourself in español.
Me llama is Kate.
It's embarrassing. And I think it's a major loss. Dad could have given us a key to communicate fluently in two languages. Instead, he installed a lock.
I think he just, at that point in time, just didn't think that it was necessary or beneficial or interesting.
But I wanted to know for sure. What were his reasons? Why let his mother tongue die? It's a scenario that plays out in plenty of families. How did it play out in my own? Whenever you interview your family, unexpected stuff dredges up. And in searching for the answer to this question, my language question, other stuff definitely came up. Like what my dad had to deal with just for speaking Spanish.
I mean, you know that he was called the Beaner when he was a kid.
I've never. Are you serious?
Yeah. I think he was, you know, 6, 7, 8. And some kid called him that, and he didn't know what it meant.
Jesus.
I know. Yeah.
All right, Dad.
Why did you kill Spanish in our family?
I don't know. Define kill.
That was my very first question. All right, let me back up for a sec, because it will help you understand where Spanish in my family began. And that's 1923, the year my grandma, Hortensia Maria, came into the world. For a 92-year-old, grandma plays a pretty mean tango. She's a ball of joy, always has been. At her house, she takes out a scrapbook and she points to a picture. It's of a woman wearing a floral dress and carrying a classical guitar. There's a red rose in her hair. I ask, playfully, who it is.
¿Quién es?
Yo, cuando estaba más joven, tocando la guitarra.
Yep, it was her when she was much younger and playing the guitar. Now, just like my dad, Grandma was born in Honduras, but her parents died young. She wound up in an orphanage, and yet she only really remembers good times.
We pray, we dance, we sing. We were so happy to me. They were my family.
The orphanage got a lot of financial help from a local dentist. He also gave the kids jobs, and Grandma got one as a dental assistant.
That's the way I met your granddad.
The way she met my granddad. It was a love story based on bad teeth. Granddad was American from Colorado. He'd come to work for a silver mine as an electrician. He and Grandma hit it off. They married and had two boys, my father John and my uncle George. Now, the family moved a lot, going from mining jobs in Honduras to El Salvador to Colombia and Chile. Spanish was a must. Everyone spoke it, including the kids, Dad and his brother. So you'd think as kids they would have talked to each other in Spanish. I mean, that's a language that surrounded them. Not so. I found that kind of odd, and so did Uncle George.
You're bringing up an interesting point. John and I never really sat down and had a conversation in Spanish just between the two of us.
Yeah, if we were in a room by ourselves, that we'd speak English.
Dad has no clue why.
I don't know.
But Uncle George thinks it may have been an order from his dad, the electrician from Colorado.
I remember where it became an issue is when Dad brought John and Mom and myself up to Colorado to introduce us to his family, and none of us could communicate in English. So I think he realized then, oops, you know, we better start getting these kids speaking English. So at that point, I believe that's when they kind of laid down the rule where Dad would speak to us in English and Mom in Spanish.
Sounds ideal. 50% English, 50% Spanish. Except pretty soon, English took the lead. The mining company my grandfather worked for was British. They ran the schools, and all the instruction was in English, aluminium and all. All these facts I knew, but then my dad told me a story, and as I heard it, I thought maybe I found the reason why Spanish died in our family.
One time in Colorado, We stopped at a little restaurant in a little town to get some lunch. And we sat down, and then the lady, you could see her start, we were the only ones in there, and she started to come over, and then I said something to Mom in Spanish, and she just stopped and turned around and went back, and then we sat there in like 10 minutes, and they just, the waitress and the cooks were just sitting back by the counters just looking at us. And finally Dad, I think, realized. He goes, okay, let's go.
It's so strange to hear this, because when you see Dad, you see a Caucasian man. So it's crazy to know he had to deal with stuff like this, all due to language. But Dad was quick to stress that this was the only time something like this happened to his family. And then he double stressed. He insisted to me that the experience had zero influence on why he didn't teach me Spanish. In fact, if there is a constant in my family, it's that Spanish is beloved.
It's melodic, it's poetic, it's expressive. It's a deeper beauty of, there's just something about the language that resonates deep down inside.
Uncle George is right. Just listen to Dad speak it.
Quiero que vamos a ir a comer mañana. ¿Podemos llevar a la abuela? Claro que sí. Vamos a la margarita.
Gorgeous, right? And that's why it's so damn frustrating. Which gets us back to where we started.
Why did you kill Spanish in our family?
I don't know. Define kill.
Getting Dad to give me a satisfying answer took close to 2 hours. And if I can break down his reasons, they went like this, in ascending order of importance. His wife, my mom, doesn't speak Spanish. In the 1980s, it wasn't a big thing to teach kids language early. Dad honestly thought we could just pick it up in high school and be fine. But the biggest reason, and the one that changed the way I look at him, is honestly the one I'm still trying to grasp. Dad doesn't feel like he's fluent. In fact, by the time he had his kids, Spanish was far away in his past.
By that time, remember, you know, like last time I'd had been around Spanish was 8th grade, when I moved away from Chile. So it's really, I think, it stopped at 8th grade. So that, my Spanish is really, it's really true. If you don't use it, you definitely lose it.
So the choice to pass down a half-assed language wasn't something he wanted or felt comfortable doing. And even the couple times he tried, I was...
annoyed. Because I remember a few times I'd try to explain words, and it was like, you just were not interested. And I'm sure as a kid you're thinking, what, I don't need this. What, you know, nobody in my sphere of living uses it, except Grandma.
But Grandma speaks English, so I just went with that. Dad could only imagine one scenario where he might have felt comfortable enough to do it.
I think probably if both my parents were Honduran and, you know, I came to the United States in my 20s or afterwards, then I bet I'd probably have been easier to speak in Spanish.
The only time Dad really uses his Spanish now is with Grandma. And remember the part about her being an orphan? Well, that means he has no other Spanish-speaking relatives, ones that he knows. The pool shrinks. The consequence of this is that everyone in my family, Dad, Uncle George, and even Grandma, are forgetting the language and speaking Spanglish.
She'll ask, can you parquear the car nearby? And I'll go parquear. And the Spanish is estacionar. I think a lot of people that live here use those words. They're just adopting, you know, kind of the English word for it and giving it a Latin twist, and that's what they use.
So a dog becomes a doguito, a match transforms from a fósforo to a matcha. Soon enough, in every conversation, you drop in Spanglish. Dad wishes he didn't have to create such words. He wishes he could speak more fluent Spanish. And he frames this desire in a story. It starts back when he was in the U.S. military. He met a fellow soldier whose parents were from Mexico, and they quickly hit it off and started talking to each other in Spanish.
We were both bemoaning the fact that we could not carry on a college-level philosophical conversation in Spanish. Our vocabulary was so stunted in Spanish, even though we could carry on a kind of a fluent conversation with each other. And that's interesting. That reminds me. Then they have the officer come in asking us not to speak Spanish.
Wait, what?
Yeah, he said it would upset some of the other men because they didn't understand what we were talking about. And it was like I rolled my eyes. He was the captain. I was a lieutenant. So I just, yeah, okay, sir.
When he finishes that story, I get mad and then sad. Mad at the captain for being a jerk, but sad for Dad and his frustration at his own lack of fluency. It's like your whole life you think someone is awesome at something, but in reality, they're not all that great. And yet, I still couldn't let it go.
There's this, maybe it's chagrin? No, not even chagrin. It's like a grudge I hold against you.
Well, again, you know, I could teach you, well, I don't know. It's like, you know, perhaps I should have sat down and we had, you know, hired a Spanish tutor, but it was, I don't think, I don't know. A good question. I don't know.
That wasn't a question. It was a statement. I'm holding the grudge against you.
It's just, you know, I can't worry about that. It's, you know.
Something I'll have to deal with myself.
Yeah, you're going to have to, yeah, get yourself an appointment, get a therapist, and work your way through it.
We blame our parents for a lot of our failures in life. Yet in this instance, it was my own damn fault. Sure, Dad didn't teach Spanish to me as a kid, but when I studied it in high school and college, I had an advantage over most of my peers. I could practice my Spanish with a native speaker whenever I wanted. And yet for some reason, I never picked up the phone. My father didn't kill Spanish. I did. Spanish, though, sprang back to life.
Hola.
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 My sister had a baby girl, Eva, and they're already practicing their holas. But my sister, she's still leery of passing down a language she herself has trouble speaking.
Maybe my job isn't to teach Eva Spanish. My job is to help Eva obtain an appreciation for the desire to speak Spanish because of her family history.
My dad, however, he's gung-ho. There are language immersion programs in schools where my sister lives. He's pushing to enroll Eva. I wouldn't say it's a total do-over. He just wants Eva to speak another language. In Spanish would be nice.
I mean, the best time is right now. You know, she's 2 years old. Right now is the best time to really learn it.
So Eva may be our Spanish savior. That's a lot of pressure to put on a two-year-old. But it's not all on her. Because anyone can learn their family language. All you gotta do is try.
Hello?
Hello, abuelita, ¿cómo estás?
Oh, muy bien. ¿Y tú cómo estás?
Muy bien. ¿Vamos a practicar español?
Sí, tenemos que practicar español, sí, sí.
¿R con R?
R con R, cigarro.
For the world, I'm Bradley Campbell.
R con R cigarro.
R con R.
Yeah, you just got to try. We have snapshots of Bradley's family at pri.org/language. And Bradley's story features in the latest episode of our podcast, The World in Words. Again, the podcast is at pri.org/language. And, of course, at iTunes. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The American Civil War lasted a little more than 4 years. The Syrian Civil War, it's heading into its sixth year with no clear end in sight. Peace talks struggle to get underway in Geneva today, and no one is expecting a breakthrough. Amr Al-Azm is a supporter of the Syrian opposition. He's also a professor of Middle Eastern history at Shawnee State University in Ohio. He says as the war grinds on, so will Europe's refugee crisis.
If Europe thinks that they've seen the peak of this refugee crisis, then they're very much mistaken. And I've met with several Europeans in the last week or so, and they're all very, very aware that as soon as spring comes, there's going to be a new wave that's, I think, going to put what happened last year, you know, it's going to pale in comparison that is pushing these refugees into the neighboring countries.
There were a million refugees entering Europe last year. You think it can get worse?
There are. That is certainly going to increase, given that their situation in the camps in the host countries that they are in at the moment, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, is only deteriorating. And the hope of a resolution is looking further and further away. So when people lose hope, they decide to risk their lives. And remember, for people to cross over into Europe, this is not a leisurely walk. This is not a pleasant, oh, well, I'll just take myself and go. They're putting their lives at risk. 20 people drowned just this week in the Aegean Sea, trying to get across, women and children. You don't take these kinds of risks unless you know that where you are at the moment is even worse than where you might be going to, and the dangers that you will face in the process of this crossing.
You were just in Europe, Amr. What did people there say about the prospect of an escalation of the refugee crisis the way you're describing it, and how do they link that to the need to staunch the war in Syria?
I mean, they're obviously very, very concerned. I've spoken to a number of people, European government-type officials, and they are very, very concerned. They're very aware that this wave is going to come starting in spring, and they are desperately trying to find ways to kind of reduce that or restrict that. But in my opinion, they're not addressing the elephant in the room. The only way to stop this is to go back and create a safe zone. The refugees move because they feel unsafe. If the refugees could find a safe haven inside Syria, then they would not move. And the only way to create a safe haven for them really is to create a no-fly zone. Everybody talks about ISIS, everybody talks about the war on terror, but it's not really ISIS that's driving these refugees out. The real driver for refugees is the barrel bombing, is now also the really, really, really very terrible and very heavy bombing by the Russians as well that's been added, in addition to coalition bombing.
I mean, we have heard from a lot of refugees that they are fleeing ISIS, and it certainly is kind of the focus of U.S. policy right now towards Syria, is to stop the extremism, to stop ISIS. But maybe you have a better sense of what U.S. policy really is all about right now in Syria generally. Do you have a handle on it?
Yes, of course. As far as I understand it, really right now, all they are trying to do, you know, is just make sure that whoever the next president is going to be, no matter whether it's Republican or Democrat, is handed a Syria file that is as calm as possible. So all they're looking at doing right now is to try and calm it down. And that is no strategy. That is no solution. All you're doing is just passing the buck on down.
What could the Europeans do realistically on their own if they wanted to try to do something about the war in Syria?
I mean, the problem for the Europeans is as follows. They've been following the U.S. Lead, as they usually do, right from the very start. But unfortunately, what's good for the United States, what's good for this president, at least what this White House thinks is good for it, is not necessarily good for the Europeans. And effectively, in my opinion, the Europeans have literally, they weren't pushed under the bus by the U.S. on the Syria issue, which ultimately created this humanitarian catastrophe and this massive refugee influx into their countries. What they've done is actually they themselves have laid down willingly under the bus and allowed the Americans to drive the bus over them quite a few number of times. Mm. They knew about this. I and many others warned the Europeans on several occasions that if a humanitarian catastrophe is allowed to develop, if a major refugee crisis is allowed to develop, then there is only one place these people are going to go eventually. You know, it's not rocket science to know that if you create a massive displacement of population in a country like Syria that ends up in a neighboring country like Turkey, once these people lose hope, once these people feel that they're going to start to move again, and they're going to move in one and one direction only, and that is Europe. And that's exactly what's happened. In fact, it's surprising it's taken this long.
Amr Al-Azam, a supporter of the Syrian opposition. He's also a professor of Middle Eastern history at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Always great to get your take, Amr. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
And finally, we end the week with a new song by Miami-based DJ and record producer Michael Brune. Brune is originally from Haiti, and for this track, he wanted to go back home and record with a special group of young people. I'm going to let him explain.
The song that I want to talk to you guys about today is actually what's playing right now, and it's called Wherever I Go. I created it with the Audio Institute in Jacmel, Haiti. It's a music school that's full tuition paid for its students and allows anyone who's talented to come in, usually from poorer families, to have the opportunity to get a great education in the arts and to eventually hopefully have a career as well. And I love the concept of that, and I wanted to ask the faculty and the students if they would be interested in doing a song together. I went there in June 2015 and we worked together on it, and it turned out amazing. I'm so proud of this.
Driving down this road for an hour, trying to get away. I could go to Rome or De Janeiro, but it all looks the same. Miles and miles I traveled, though I never found someone like you. I can't explain it, you're inside my head. Wherever I go, I see you. Wherever I go.
So the song is actually getting released today, and what's really special about this is this experience of creating the song with the students and with the school was really eye-opening, and seeing that we could do something as a community and as Haitians to make a track together that was very positive and uplifting, and to get so many people from different walks of life involved in it. And what I wanted to do was give back the proceeds of this to the school so that they can continue creating scholarships and giving opportunities to these really talented students.
Every time we touch, turn to fire, but we both love the pain.
That's DJ Michael Bruhn talking about his new song, Wherever I Go, recorded with the Audio Institute in Jacmel, Haiti. Our own cue to go, the world's theme music, was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.